Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
This is the second part of our mini-series on slowing down fast fashion.
In part one, we looked at ways to change our throwaway clothing culture among consumers, but found that none of the efforts to reduce, reuse, and recycle had made a dent in fast fashion's ever-increasing production of new clothes.
After concluding once again that we can't shop our way out of the climate crisis, Emily Stokel of Remake turned our attention in a new direction.
Higher wages could revolutionize that whole business model of fast fashion because it would force those companies to slow down and make less.
So that's where we were at the end of part one. Since then, I've read some analyses of the fast fashion market, which suggest that raising wages really would work because inflation is succeeding where the three R's failed. Rising costs for materials in the fast fashion supply chain has translated into higher retail prices and slower sales. But inflation isn't forever, thank God. If we want to throw a more permanent monkey wrench into the production of ultra-cheap clothes and greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to have to engage in policy work.
Labor standards go hand in hand with the impact of the garment industry to the environment.
That's Marissa Nuncio, director of the Garment Workers Center in Los Angeles.
It's impossible to produce at that level without exploiting people.
Last year, a small group of Los Angeles garment workers won a historic victory against that exploitation, passing a law which is causing a ripple effect throughout the global garment industry.
This could be the first domino in the fall of fast fashion and a return to sustainable clothing production.
When most people think of fast fashion factories, they think about places like Bangladesh and Indonesia. But some of the largest fast fashion brands in the world, like Forever 21, Fashion Nova, and Mango, sell clothes made in the USA, mostly in Los Angeles' garment district.
If a label on your garment says made in the US, by and large, it was made here in LA. Los Angeles is the garment production capital of the US.
That made in the U.S. label doesn't guarantee that the garment workers got fair wages or safe working conditions.
Unfortunately, Los Angeles is also the sweatshop capital of the U.S. Folks will assume made in the U.S. must mean basic adherence to labor laws. And unfortunately, that's just not the case.
Francisco Zuhl, an L.A. garment worker, describes the conditions that led him to become an activist.
Soy originalmente de Guatemala. Y trabajé como trabajador de la costura por muchos años, tanto en mi país como en México. Pero lo que nunca me imaginé es que en la ciudad de Los Ángeles iba a experimentar algo igual o peor que en mi país de origen.
I'm originally from Guatemala, and I worked as a garment worker for many years in my own country and in Mexico. I never expected that conditions in LA would be just as bad or even worse than my own country.
Yo he estado trabajando 6 días a la semana, de 7 a 7, ganando $350, $400 en edificios en muy malas condiciones. Incluso hay ratas, hay cucarachas. En el verano es prácticamente como en un infierno, porque una pequeña ventana es todo lo que tiene y no tenemos ventilación.
I was working 6 days a week from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., earning $300 to $450 a week in buildings with very bad conditions, including rats and roaches, sweltering heat, and no ventilation.
Workers are inhaling fabric fibers that are often treated with chemicals all day long. Blocked exits are pretty much the norm. Bathrooms lack running water. That's certainly not what a lot of people think when they think of a U.S. factory.
Francisco was not alone. A survey done by the Garment Workers Center and the UCLA Labor Center found that around half of garment workers reported working under those conditions.
And when the U.S. Department of Labor inspected a random selection of 77 factories in Southern California, making clothes for companies like Ross, TJ Maxx, Forever 21, Nordstrom, and Macy's, it found 85% were not paying minimum wage or overtime. The Garment Workers Center was established to change that.
Our mission is to create a base of empowered, educated, agitated workers who want to transform their industries.
Their story really starts back in 1995, when state and federal officials raided an LA area apartment complex where 72 Thai women had been held for years in a razor wire enclosed compound and forced to work as slaves in a makeshift garment factory. After the raid, instead of being freed, the victims were imprisoned again by immigration authorities. A coalition of immigrant rights, labor, and religious organizations protested for 9 days to free them and then assisted the released workers. One outgrowth of this campaign was recognition by coalition members of the need for an organization dedicated to fighting for the rights of all garment workers, who may not have been physically held against their will, but were still lacking the basic human rights afforded to workers in other industries. The idea for the Garment Worker Protection Act really grew out of a failure.
Workers were waging a campaign against a brand called Ross, a discount retailer known for selling what you call dead stock or overstock, but they actually also produced their own line of clothing under different names. We had a group of four workers, just four, who were owed over $800,000.
At the time, most garment workers were being paid piece rate, on average about 2 cents per seam. If that ended up to be less than minimum wage, state law required employers to make up the difference.
But they just never did it. If a worker was paid on the piece, they were paid by the piece.
To understand how employers got away with that, you need to know how our clothing gets made.
Fashion brands do not directly employ the workers that are producing their clothing. They hire intermediary companies, and then that intermediary will subcontract to factories.
There was already a law on the books which was supposed to protect garment workers by holding manufacturers responsible for wages owed by their subcontractors. But the retailers, the brands that you see on the clothes, escaped liability because they don't contract directly with the factories. The workers sewing for Ross filed a wage claim with the Labor Commission. The commission found in their favor, but the manufacturer and the factory both shut down and never paid them.
That's their common MO. They shut down and reopened in another location under the name of another family member.
Ross was not required to pay anything.
Brands legally could say, I have zero liability for their wages.
But these brands really are responsible because they're not paying their contractors enough to pay their employees a minimum wage.
Our Department of Labor conducted an investigation. They were found to be paying about half of what was necessary for minimum wage to be complied with.
All groups like the Garment Worker Center could do was try to shame the brands with public exposure.
They protested in front of Ross Stores, the company headquarters in Dublin, California, and even in front of the owner's apartment building in New York City.
Si se puede means yes, it's possible, or roughly translated, we can do it. But the garment workers had to face the fact that what they were doing wasn't working.
It was this real frustrating moment for workers where they were like, we can be owed that much money. It can be that dire. And this multi-billion dollar company, I think at the time, their annual revenue was about $15 billion. And they can just ignore us. And they actually have no obligation to ever give us a meeting, to ever pay any attention to this wage claim. And it was just this moment where we said, well, we're not getting anywhere. We had to be really frank with ourselves. We're losing this campaign. And that was a pivotal moment when we had to just sit down and sort of lick our wounds, to be frank, and say, I think it's time to wrap this campaign. This brand is ignoring us. One of the things we say, if you lose a campaign, you immediately start another one.
When workers sat down to talk about what that should be, they came up with an ambitious plan.
The law's not working for us. We've got to change the law. They identified two things that were key. Fashion brands have to be accountable because they have the most power, plain and simple. They hold the power in the supply chain to dictate the wages and working conditions through what they pay for their garment orders. They have the most negotiating power in that supply chain, and they garner the largest profits. So they should be responsible.
But that alone wasn't enough.
If we're still earning our livelihood 2 cents at a time, we haven't achieved what we need to achieve.
They had to get rid of piecework, which put them in a perpetual battle to collect the remainder of their wages. Now that they knew what they wanted the law to do, they needed a lawmaker to sponsor the bill. They approached State Senator Maria Elena Durazo, a child of Mexican immigrants with a long history of labor leadership.
I'll always remember this meeting. The senator said, well, you have to tell me what your bottom lines are. You're trying to achieve all of this, or really you just maybe want one of these demands? And I remember our members very clearly saying, no, these are our bottom lines. And it was this great moment where I think she really understood they're going to fight for this. And she said yes.
And the Garment Worker Protection Act was born.
We introduced the bill in February of 2020. But then in March of 2020, everything shut down. The legislature, businesses, our organizations. And it was another moment of saying, oh, what do we do? Should we withdraw the bill? Maybe we introduce again next year. And our members said, no, we have to keep fighting. We did these big trainings over the phone, outside of houses, so that workers could learn how to get on Zoom. And to be frank, it was chaos at first. But workers did it.
They started out by making a power map.
A power map is looking at your landscape. Who supports your demands? Who's your opposition? Who's in the middle? Where can you build more support? You map that out and you sort of rate folks' level of support as well as their power and influence on the folks that can make the final decision. In this instance, it was our legislature. And then they looked at geography and looked at, well, where are certain legislators and what organizations there might have a relationship with particular legislators? And then would reach out to those organizations and ask folks to join us. Part of waging a successful campaign is to not do it alone. You just won't have enough power and reach. You have to build alliances. Endorsements came from labor, worker rights organizations, economic justice organizations, student groups, faith-based groups, immigrant rights organizations.
On the other side, opposing the bill were the Chamber of Commerce, the American Apparel and Footwear Association, and the California Retailers Association. They called it a job killer.
They said garment manufacturers would leave the state. In the midst of an exodus of large companies and rich residents, shrinking the state's tax base, that job killer claim could have killed the bill. But the garment workers had identified some important new allies in their power mapping. California clothing companies who were already doing the right thing.
One by one, we just started meeting with them. That was very new for us, and it was an experiment. We were like, I don't know, are folks going to want to align with us? And they did. They have a different message to share. If you're a fashion brand trying to stay in California, that message resonates completely differently than a labor organization's message. And so their voice and their message was so important.
Here's one company owner bringing that message to a Senate committee.
My name is Kristen Fanarakis, and I'm the founder and designer of Senza Tempo, a classically inspired luxury line made in downtown Los Angeles. I'm one of the 145 and growing fashion industry businesses in support of this bill. Wage theft is a systemic issue that is built into the business model of large fashion corporations. It's not an isolated incident. Passing SB 62 will have no effect on a business that is already following the law by paying the minimum wage. And assigning joint liability will have no impact on a company that has done their due diligence on their factory. California must pass SB 62 to level the playing field for companies like mine.
Clothing brands like Ross and Forever 21 that were profiting from wage theft never came forward individually in opposition, preferring to hide behind their trade organizations.
The ethical fashion companies brought something else to the campaign.
They helped make it kind of cool and fashionable too, you know, like they would take it upon themselves to create their own social media assets and graphics and create their own branding or style to the message.
And that grew support from another corner.
From Gen Zers and ethical fashionistas and influencers.
You're listening to Cool Solutions. We're talking with Marissa Nuncio from the LA Garment Workers Center about how a small group of garment workers in California passed the world's first law making fashion brands accountable for fair wages, and the power of this precedent to raise garment worker wages and lower fashion emissions. All of this is going on in the early part of the pandemic, in an industry known for ignoring public health precautions.
Our members were getting sick with COVID, hospitalized. We lost members. You know, they lost their housing because they lost their jobs. Paid sick leave is just unheard of in the garment industry.
Francisco's factory was shut down twice by the county health department for outbreaks that infected hundreds of workers.
Francisco himself was hospitalized for COVID, losing his job in the process.
Garment worker Magdalena Otui called out the hypocrisy of the state failing to protect the very workers producing protective equipment in her testimony to the Assembly Labor Committee.
Durante la pandemia seguimos trabajando muchos cosiendo mascarillas y bates de hostales. Hasta nos han llamado trabajadores esenciales, pero no me pagan el salario mínimo.
During the pandemic, we continued working, many of us sewing masks and hospital gowns. They even designated us essential workers, but I am not paid the minimum wage.
A la semana yo gano $300. De lunes a viernes trabajo 40 horas para marcas como Forever 21, Papaya, LNA.
I make $300 from Monday to Friday for a full week of work. For multi-million dollar companies like Forever 21, Papaya, and LNA. And these brands are million dollar companies because they create contracts, knowing that the workers will only be paid mere cents for their work. For this wage theft to end, we need to eliminate the piece rate and create accountability from the brands for the wage theft they cause.
Passing the Garment Worker Protection Act would require 8 separate votes. It had to be passed by 3 committees and a floor vote in the Senate, and then 3 more committees and a floor vote in the Assembly. Before each vote, Garment Center workers and their allies had to mobilize, testifying at hearings, holding press conferences, doing social media, and organizing call-in days to urge legislators to vote yes. Remember, this is on top of 12-hour workdays and taking care of their families.
The committee leaders were primarily women who are parenting, working a full day, and then they would get on a 6:30, 7 o'clock committee meeting and plan for an hour or 2 hours together. And there were moments where there were difficult campaign decisions that had to be made, and they were on the phone on Zoom until 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Vote by vote, the bill advanced, passing all the way through the Senate and the committees in the state assembly.
There's a deadline in which all bills must be voted on, and that's at the end of September. And so if your bill was not called by midnight, your bill was dead. So when we got to that deadline, when we got to that moment in 2020, our bill was not called to a vote, which was devastating. We had the votes. We would have won. We had a watch party. We were all on Zoom. It was devastating to watch and to recognize it's not going to be called. There were a lot of tears that night. There was a lot of anger and frustration. I was sobbing, and members were like, you know, we just keep fighting. That's what we do. They immediately asked Senator Durazo if she would reintroduce with them, and they reintroduced, and then they went through that process all over again.
By this time, most workers were vaccinated.
We rented multiple buses so we could be spaced apart, and we took about 50 workers up to Sacramento, and they led a lobby day. We put up tables and tents outside, and legislators came to workers. That was just this awesome moment of getting back to who we are. Like, we hadn't gathered like that, you know, so it was also just fun. Like, really, really fun. We travel overnight because workers are working, right? And so, you know, we get on the bus overnight. What I love about our members is, like, they will just be a blast on these caravans and singing and just acting up and having fun overnight. And then they get down to business. There was a leader for each meeting. They divided up talking points and roles. And they just got to work and just handled business that day. Held multiple meetings. They held a press conference on the Capitol steps.
And they won the votes they needed one by one.
Senator Durazo was a steadfast ally.
To my colleague from Ripon, who suggested that somehow peace work is a good thing, the truth is, the piecework that they're being paid for, you never even hit minimum wage. These aren't auto workers. These are women in sweatshop-like conditions sewing things for 2 cents. 2 cents per item. Can you imagine? I remember hearing from one woman who told me at first she thought she had a good job because before she had the job in the garment industry, she was human trafficked and got $0. So she thought it was okay because she was making money and then realized that she could never make enough money to get by. And she told me how she had to keep her daughter in a box next to her sewing machine because she couldn't stop. She couldn't afford childcare for her child. She literally had her child in a box in the sewing machine as she's making your 2 cent mask that somebody sold to you for $10. Well, that person who sold it to you for $10 needs to make her whole. That's what this bill is about. It's about ensuring that everybody in this state who does work gets a minimum wage. My God, it's 2021. We're fighting for workers to earn a minimum wage and holding people responsible who are making the profits off of their low pay. If we can't do that, I don't know what we can do.
There were actually some beautiful moments where we learned that some legislators, their mothers or their grandmothers were garment workers.
This is Senator John Sawyer.
My mother worked in the garment industry for 2 decades. And I remember the long hours, the low pay. I remember when the workers, they got a swamp fan in there and they thought they had died and gone to heaven because the sweltering heat in that place was so bad. So I have seen the impacts of these injustices and exploitative practices have on garment workers at the hands of this industry. These companies should not be allowed to use loopholes in state law to make billions of dollars in profits and not pay their workers what they are owed. I want to thank you because I get to show my mother why she raised me. I get to show my mother why I'm here. This is a righteous bill, and we should move forward with it. So thank you.
Madam Secretary, roll call on SB 62, please.
Motion is due pass to Judiciary Committee. Calra?
Aye.
Calra, aye. Flora? Gonzalez?
Aye.
Gonzalez, aye. Jones Sawyer?
For my mother, aye.
Ward?
Aye.
Ward, aye.
That bill is out on the way to Judiciary. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, members.
The bill finally passed both houses and was delivered to the governor's desk, but it would not become law unless the governor signed it within 12 days. Other bills to protect garment worker wages had been vetoed by previous governors, and this bill had already died once from a missed deadline. As the days ticked down with no word from the governor's office, workers became worried it could happen again. They organized postcard parties and Twitter storms, urging Governor Newsom to sign the bill. Finally, 48 hours before the deadline,
we got an email from the governor's office that says, please join this Zoom event. And so immediately we're texting the Senator Durazo's office. What does this mean? Does that mean we won? Why is the governor asking us to a meeting? This has to mean he's approving, right? Finally, like just a little before that conference, we got confirmation.
The bill was signed into law on September 27th, 2021.
And then we all got together after via Zoom and cried and cheered outside in our like driveway. We just somehow immediately had food and music.
Thank you so much. I hope that we all take this moment, because this is a historic moment. I hope that we take this moment in history and we use it to build our spirit. We use it to build our resilience so that we can keep fighting for justice. Quiero cerrar en decir y recordarnos que nos enseña esta victoria.
I want to close by saying, what does this victory teach us?
Nos enseña que cuando los trabajadores organizan, se puede lograr cambio monumental, monumental. Y cuando la comunidad escucha a los trabajadores y luchan con ellos, todos ganamos.
When workers organize, they can achieve monumental change. And when the community listens to workers and fights with them, everybody wins.
Muchísimas gracias a todos. Thank you so much to everybody.
And we just danced. Honestly, we just danced for Holland. We'll be right back. 62 went into effect January 1st of 2022. A bill only works if people know how to use it, if they know how to assert their rights and what their rights are. So we've been working a lot with our labor enforcement agencies to conduct mass outreach, both to workers and to businesses. What we know is still very anecdotal. We are having members come to us and say, my employer is paying by the hour now.
With California's $15 minimum wage, that's double or triple what they earned before.
Now, if a factory doesn't pay minimum wage in overtime, all the worker has to do is bring the brand labels to the Labor Commission and they'll make the brand pay instead.
While that's huge for garment workers in California, the new law has potential to help workers far beyond the state's borders.
You know, we often get our rights sort of bill by bill and campaign by campaign.
But legislation can spur changes in our culture, which spread far beyond legal jurisdictions.
We can use policy campaigns to socialize and normalize the idea that fashion brands should be responsible for the wages and working conditions in their supply chain. It is not a generally accepted norm in this industry. It's never been the case. And so pushing legislation sets an expectation of what the norm should be.
And that message has traveled all the way to Washington, where a federal bill modeled on California's Garment Worker Protection Act, called the Fabric Act, was introduced in 2022.
We don't think that workers should have to cobble their protections state by state. We should have a better floor across the country. And our members are just thrilled that it was their model that inspired this federal legislation.
There are other laws in the works which would make brand responsibility global. In New York State, the Fashion Act would make fashion companies with gross receipts over $100 million responsible for fair wages for the workers sewing their clothes, as well as for reducing emissions in their supply chains. This law would apply to companies all over the world who sell apparel in New York State.
The EU is considering another policy with global impact that would require all garments sold in the EU by 2030 to be long-lived and recyclable and produced in respect of social rights and the environment.
That would basically eliminate the world's largest market for cheap throwaway clothes. The New York Fashion and Federal Fabric Acts didn't pass in 2022, but both are being reintroduced.
There are things you can do right now to support garment workers and move this vision forward. We've got links on our website, cool-solutions.org, to support the Fabric and Fashion Acts and to find clothing brands not made in sweatshops.
You've been listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to Roland Geyer, Emily Stokel, Marisa Nuncio, Francisco Zul, and Magdalena Otui.
And to Scott Holmes, Marisa Anderson, Mr. Smith, and Siddhartha Korsis for our music.